Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
And tonight we have bring you a pretty good show. We will bring you some alternative news and, well, news that isn't focused on by the mainstream media. And we'll also bring you an interview that was tape-recorded last night on our show done on Q103.3 FM on Lakeville, Connecticut, with John Brennan.
John is a weekly guest of ours, and he is a reporter. Basically, he talks about, brings us up to date on the chemtrail issues and by some environmental issues.
Yeah, something that Leo and I are very concerned about, but John, that's his specialty. He tries to look for new articles and new things on it and people aware.
He's an activist, and one that, and a voice that we enjoy having and listening to. And we want, and tonight he was also in the, went down to the 911 tribute there down in New York City, but he said there was approximately 4,000 people that were at the protest, 911 Truth Movement, that were protesting the cover up, you know, and trying to make people aware of it. And he talks about that, and he has an interview that was done by, believe it or not, Russia Today, which is one of the only media outlets that covered the 911 protest
demonstration.
And and we'll be running that tonight too, so we hope you enjoy that. But in the meantime, Lila can read one of the articles we have here, and we'll be bringing that up in about 15-20 minutes.
Doctors say flu vaccine will cause 60,000 deaths in France alone, and this is from Alex Jones, PrisonPlanet.com. Dr. Marc Girard, a specialist in side effects of drugs and a medical expert commissioned by French courts, has said on French TV that the swine flu vaccine could cause 60,000 deaths in France, especially among young people, children, and pregnant women. He also said that people promoting the swine flu vaccine are doing so because they have links with the pharmaceutical company. The problem with the swine flu vaccine is that it's not just badly developed, but not developed, he said, adding that it's being prepared in conditions that endanger the public health. And this is a quote of what he said in a translation. A vaccine is being developed in conditions of amateurism such as I have never seen. Let's take the pessimistic hypothesis, one death among every 1,000 patients. There are plans to vaccinate 60 million people, and you already have 60,000 deaths, and this time, young people, children, and pregnant women. What you are saying is serious because many people are getting ready to get the vaccine, and you are saying you must not get a vaccination. Yes, it is a vaccine that has been developed at great speed in conditions that put in danger the public health. There is a need to return back to the obligation that politicians have right now to protect citizens against the desire of the pharmaceutical industry to make money with all these vaccines. There is a public health code of law from 2007 which obliges all health professionals who give their opinions to reveal their interests. The law is ridiculed every day. All the people who you are seeing, who you see saying the flu, it's very serious, have interests. Their lines interests. And that is why they say what they say. So that when he says their lines, that maybe their company's interests. The Public Health Administration is an example to us of a daily violation of the law. I am a medical specialist, and I am against medicines that have no purpose. This vaccine is not just badly developed, it is not developed. And that's what he's saying. Also, here's an article from Rents.com. Italy ex-president, CIA, and Mossad ran 9/11. Former Italian President Francisco Cossiga, who revealed the existence of Operation Gladio, has told Italy's oldest and most widely read newspaper that the 9/11 terrorist attacks were run by the CIA and Mossad, and this was common knowledge among the global intelligence agencies. In what translates awkwardly into English, Cossiga told the newspaper Corriere della Sera, and I quote, "All the intelligence services of America and Europe know well that the disastrous attack has been planned and realized from the Mossad with the aid of the Zionist world order to put under accusation the Arabic countries and in order to induce the Western powers to take part in Iraq and Afghanistan." Cossiga was elected president of the Italian Senate in July 1983 before winning a landslide election to become president of the country in 1985, where he remained until 1992. Cossiga's tendency to be outspoken against the Italian political establishment and it upset them, and he was forced to resign after revealing the existence of and his part in the setting up of Operation Gladio. This was a rogue intelligence network under NATO auspices that carried out bombings across Europe in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Gladio's specialty was to carry out what they termed false flag operation terror attacks that were blamed on their domestic and geopolitical opposition. In March 2001, Gladio agent Vincenzo Vinciguerra stated in sworn testimony, and I quote, "You had to attack civilians, the people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people far removed from any political game. The reason was quite simple, to force the public to turn to the state to ask for greater security." Cossiga first expressed his doubts about 9/11 in 2001 and is quoted by 9/11 researcher Webster Tarpley saying, and I quote, "The mastermind of the attack must have been a sophisticated mind, provided with ample means not only to recruit fanatic kamikazes, but also highly specialized personnel. I add one thing, it could not be accomplished without infiltrations in the radar and flight security personnel." Coming from a widely respected former head of state, Cossiga's assertion that the 9/11 attacks were an inside job, and this is common knowledge among global intelligence agencies, is illuminating. It is one more eye-opening confirmation that has not been mentioned by America's propaganda machine in print or on TV. Nevertheless, because of his experience and status in the world, Cossiga cannot be discounted as a crackpot. So that's a good article and interesting. So he said that he came out before and said that.
Okay.
So a few months back.
Yeah, would you mind reading that one for me? Well, I'm still trying to...
Leo is still trying to get the interview ready to be played. It's a little difficult. This is from Bloomberg.com. Stiglitz says banking problems are now bigger than the pre-Lehman. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, said the U.S. has failed to fix the underlying problems of its banking system after the credit crunch and the collapse of Lehman Brothers Holdings Incorporated. In the U.S. and many other countries, the too-big-to-fail banks have become even bigger, Stiglitz said in an interview today in Paris. The problems are worse than they were in 2007 before the crises. Stiglitz's views echo those of former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, who has advised President Barack Obama's administration to curtail the size of banks, and the Bank of Israel governor, Stanley Fisher, who suggested last month that the governments may want to discourage financial institutions from growing excessively. A year after the demise of Lehman forced the Treasury Department to spend billions to shore up the financial system, Bank of America Corp assets have grown and Citigroup and Corp remains intact. In the UK, Lloyds Banking Group PC, 43% owned by the government, has taken over the activities of HBOS PIC, and in France, BNP Paribas SA now owns the Belgian and Luxembourg banking assets of insurers Fortis. While Obama wants to name some banks as systemically important and subject them to stricter oversight, his plan wouldn't force them to shrink or simplify their structure. Stiglitz says that the U.S. government is wary of challenging the financial industry because it's politically difficult, and that he hopes the group of 20 leaders will cajole the U.S. into tougher action. G20 steps. We aren't doing anything significant so far, and the banks are pushing back, he said. The leaders of the G20 will make some small steps forward, given the power of the banks, and steps forward is a move in the right direction. G20 leaders gather next week in Pittsburgh and will consider ways of improving regulation of financial markets, and in particular, how to set tighter limits on remuneration for market operators. Under pressure from France and Germany, G20 finance ministers last week reached a preliminary accord that included proposals to claw back cash awards and linking compensation more closely to long-term performance. It is an outrage, especially in the U.S., where we poured so much money into the banks, Stiglitz said. The administration seems very reluctant to do what is necessary. Yes, they'll do something. The question is, will they do as much as required? Stiglitz, former chief economist at the World Bank and member of the White House Council of Economic Advisers, said the world economy is far from being out of the woods, even if it is pulled back from the precipice that's teetered on after the collapse of Lehman. We're going into an extended period of weak economy, of economic malaise, Stiglitz said. The U.S. will grow, but not enough to offset the increase in the population, he said, adding that if workers do not have income, it's very hard to see how the U.S. will generate the demand that the world economy needs. The Federal Reserve faces a quandary in ending its monetary stimulus program because doing so may drive up the cost of borrowing for the U.S. government, he said. The question then is, who's going to finance the U.S. government, Stiglitz said. Interesting.
Okay. And I have one here that, do you have anything else that this?
No, I finished those.
Okay. And,
Well, do you want me to start that?
You want me to do that? I'm still working on this thing.
You're still working on that.
We have an overlap here.
This is Obama clones push in Bush in Obama clones Bush in killing sovereignty. And this is from WorldNet Daily. President Obama is continuing President George W. Bush's effort to advance the North American integration with a public relations makeover calculated to place the program under the radar of public opinion and to deflect concerns about border security and national sovereignty. And this is from WorldNet Daily. The Obama administration has rebranded and refocused the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, or SPP, to advance the Bush administration's agenda of North American integration under the rubric of the North American Leaders Summit, a less controversial banner, according to confidential sources in the U.S. Department of Commerce and State Department, who agreed to speak with WorldNet Daily only if their comments were kept off the record. Moreover, the Guadalajara Summit was reduced to a one-day meeting, where all previous Security and Prosperity Partnership meetings were trilateral summits, and or 2 day where previous where trilateral summits had been 2 day events. Sources confirmed that the WorldNet Daily that the SPP is now being directed from within the White House, as reflected by a new blog posted on the White House website entitled "The North American Leaders Summit." The site is intended to replace the SPP.gov as the official website documenting trilateral government activities going forward under the rebranded name. The SPP website, maintained by the Department of Commerce, now has a disclaimer that reads, "This website is an archive for SPP documents and will not be updated." Sources also confirmed that the SPP mission was refocused at the Guadalajara Summit August 10th to emphasize three themes: Number one, the North American citizen security. Number two, North American economic competitiveness. And number three, North American energy policy and climate change agenda. The refocusing resulted from a think tank analysis that argued that the trilateral bureaucratic working groups created under the SPP did not pursue enough big picture agenda items to make a positive public relations impact on the national voters in the United States, Mexico, and Canada. Since sources in the State Department confirmed that more than 20 trilateral working groups will continue under the North American Leaders Summit with the bureaucrats from three nations assigned from different agencies within each government. The groups will work on the North American agenda of integrating and harmonizing administrative rules across a broad range of policy areas from transportation to border security, health, e-commerce, movement of goods, environment, energy, and financial services.
Okay.
Are we all set for our...
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much. I gotta apologize because this system that I have is not as good as
a little primitive.
And we've tried desperately to upgrade here, but unfortunately the studio that we have at the
where we do our radio show
doesn't really accommodate some of this
more advanced
technology. Advanced, but I mean it's I have to. They don't have a. It's extremely difficult to copy it on anything else other than a tape, and there. So I have to apologize for that. But nevertheless, we do have most of the interview.
Good.
With John, and he talks about the 911 issue, of course, and chemtrails and so on. So we'll be going to that right now, and here we go.
I hope you folks find it informative. It was a great interview. You did a good job.
Well, I'm trying to queue up right now. I have another audio check, and it's about it's a very interesting one. A lot of people might say, "Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist about 9/11. How could they have foreseen this sort of event? Could they ever have known that people would use airplanes to attack?" And President Bush came on C-SPAN and Condoleezza, and we could never have foreseen these sort of things. But ABC News with Peter Jennings actually played a clip which disproved that fact. And I'm trying to cue that one up. I don't know how long more we got.
We got about a minute.
10 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Can we get 10 minutes? I'll cut it down. I'm going fast forward here to try and go a little more, but
you have to excuse me on this. I have a slight problem with this thing. In the meantime, I'm going to try to entertain you somehow. I don't know if Lila read this or not. Okay. Nanoparticles used in untested H1N1 swine flu vaccines. It's the vaccine, stupid. This is by Global Research, September 13th, 2009. The vaccines, which have been approved by the responsible government authorities for vaccinations against the alleged H1N1 influenza, a swine flu, have been found to contain nanoparticles. Vaccine makers, you have to hang on 1 second for me, please. And let's see. Nanoparticles. Vaccine makers have been experimenting with nanoparticles as a way to turbocharge vaccines for several years now. It has come out that the vaccines approved for for use in Germany and other European countries contain nanoparticles in a form that reportedly attacks healthy cells and can be deadly. Could you read that, the rest of that, please, Letta? And
I had trouble with that.
Yeah.
In 2007, researchers of the École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne announced in an article in the Journal of Nature Biotechnology that they had developed a nanoparticle that can deliver vaccines more effectively with fewer side effects and at a fraction of the cost of current vaccine technologies. The article went on to describe the effects of their breakthrough. At a mere 25 nanometers, these particles are so tiny that once injected, they flow through the skin's extracellular matrix, making a beeline to the lymph nodes. Within minutes, they've reached a concentration of DCs thousands of times greater than in the skin. The immune response then can be extremely strong and effective. There is only one small problem with vaccines containing nanoparticles. They can be deadly and at least cause severe, irreparable health damages. Nanoparticles, promoted in the mass media as the new wonder revolution of science, are particles that have been produced vastly smaller than deadly asbestos particles, which cause severe lung damage and death before being outlawed. Particles at a nano size fuse together with the membranes of our body cell membranes, and according to recent studies in China and Japan, continuously destroy cells once introduced in the body. Once they interact with the body's cellular structure, they cannot be removed. Modern medicine euphemistically terms the phenomenon a continuing infectious reaction. Since the asbestos scandal, it has been established that particles in sizes of millionths of a meter, because of their enormous attractive force, penetrate all cells, destroying all those that they come in contact with. Nanoparticles are far smaller than asbestos fibers. Beijing test confirms deadly effects on humans. The fact that the WHO, the European Medicine Evaluation Agency, the German Robert Koch Institute, and other health bodies today would permit the population to be injected with largely untested novel vaccines containing nanoparticles, says more about the powerful pharma lobby in European politics than it does about the sanity or moral integrity of the civil servants responsible for health of the general public. The September 2009 issue of the respected European Respiratory Journal, made public on the 19th of August and available since the 21st of August online, contains a peer-reviewed article with the title Exposure to Nanoparticles is Related to Pleural Effusion, Pulmonary Fibrosis, and Granuloma. The article describes tests carried out in 2008 at the elite Beijing Chaoyang Hospital on seven young women. All seven, ages 18 to 47, and have been exposed to nanoparticles for 5 to 13 months in their common workplace. All were admitted to the hospital with shortness of breath and pleural effusions, or excessive fluid surrounding the lungs, inhibiting breathing. None of the seven had ever smoked. None were in any special risk group. Doctors carefully tested for every possibility and confirmed that the lung problems had a foreign origin. Regular inhalation of nanoparticles in their factory. They had been exposed to a polyacrylate nanoparticles. The test confirmed that the nanoparticles had set off a super meltdown reaction in the patients. Despite all heroic efforts of doctors, two of the seven died from lung complications. In their report, the scientists concluded something so alarming it is necessary to quote it at length. And this is what they said, and I quote, immunological tests, examinations of bacteriology, virology, and tumor markers, brachyscopy, internal thoracoscopy, and video-assisted thoracic surgery were performed. Surveys of the workplace, clinical observations, and examinations of the patients were conducted. Polyacrylate consisting of nanoparticles was confirmed in the workplace. Pathological examinations of the patient's lung tissue displayed nonspecific pulmonary inflammation, pulmonary fibrosis, and foreign body granulomas of chloria. Using transmission electron microscopy, nanoparticles were observed to lodge in the cytoplasm, the karyoplasm of pulmonary, epithelial, and mesothelial cells, but are also located in the chest fluid. These cases arouse concern that long-term exposure to some nanoparticles without protective measures may be related to serious damage in human lungs. To date, animal studies and in vitro experiments show that nanoparticles can result in lung damage and other toxicity in animals, but no reports on the clinical toxicity in humans due to nanoparticles prior to the Beijing study has been made. The Beijing Chaoyang Hospital study has now conclusively confirmed that nanoparticles cause lung damage and other toxicity in humans as well. At this point in time, when two of the approved vaccines planned to be mass distributed in Germany and elsewhere contain nanoparticles, failure of the relevant, responsible public health and epidemiology officials to order an immediate emergency freeze on distribution of any vaccine containing nanoparticles can only be considered tantamount to criminal negligence. Hopefully, the responsible authorities will relax, act in time to avert a possible human health catastrophe, orders of the magnitude worse than the worst case of the swine flu reported to date.
Okay.
So that's pretty scary.
Yeah. I'm having a lot of trouble with queuing this thing up. I've been at it for 20 minutes here.
Well, why don't you just get part of it then?
I can't because it's what happened is it overdubbed and it's different problems with it. So, but I'm working on it. This other one here, if you bear with us, this one came from Mail Online, which is in the UK. And it says, you're not intelligent enough to marry, what the bride was told.
And this actually took place in Scotland by Alison Smith Squire. Social workers barred a young woman from her own wedding in an extraordinary row over whether she is bright enough to get married. Carrie Robinson, who has mild learning difficulties, was told her wedding was being halted just 48 hours before she was to walk up the aisle with fiancé Mark McDougall. Miss Robinson, 17, had brought her wedding dress, and the couple had booked the church ceremony, bought the rings, and organized a reception to be held last Saturday. But 2 days before they were due to say their vows in front of 20 guests, social services told the bride-to-be that she would have to cancel the big day because she did not understand the implications of getting married. Yesterday, Miss Robinson, who is 5 months pregnant, said the decision was cruel. She said, I'm still so upset about everything. I know what marriage is. It is when two folks want to spend the rest of their lives together. I love Mark, and I want to get married to him. Miss Robinson of Dunfermline, Fife, has been in the care of her grandmother since she was 9 months old after her parents were unable to look after her, with their welfare overseen by social workers at Fife Council. In January this year, she met Mr. McDougall, a 25-year-old artist from Arbroath. When Miss Robinson became pregnant, they began making wedding plans. Mr. McDougall said the nightmare began last Thursday when two social workers arrived at the flat they shared for the past 4 months. He said, we were about to go out and make final arrangements for our wedding when we heard a frantic rapping at the door. When we opened it, two social workers burst in and told us that the marriage was illegal because Carrie has learning difficulties and did not possess the capacity to make such a decision. Carrie burst into tears, but despite arguing with the social workers that we loved one another and didn't want our baby to be born to unmarried parents, they wouldn't budge. Under Scottish law, a registrar may refuse to marry a couple if he leaves one or both parties lack the mental capacity to understand what the institution of marriage is about. In a highly unusual step, the registrar at Dunfermline Register Office refused to sanction the marriage after the Fife Council wrote a letter of objection. Mr. McDougall claims Miss Robertson's learning difficulties are not severe. It's true she is not very academic, he said, but she is nowhere near stupid as social services are making out. She is a loving, caring person. She can also read and write, although not very well, and was going to college to catch up. I didn't even know she had learning difficulties until we'd been dating for 2 months. At that time, social services said they were pleased we were together and seemed supportive. For the first time in her life, Carrie was truly happy, so we cannot understand what all the fuss is about. The couple are concerned that their unborn baby, a boy they have already named Ben, could be taken away if Fife Council judges Miss Robinson unable to care for him. She now faces a psychologist's assessment to determine if she's too unintelligent to get married. Mr. McDougall said, we're both going to fight all the way. We feel that we want to get married and should be encouraged, not forbidden. Helen Townsend of Fife Council said, we cannot discuss the details of individual cases for reasons of confidentiality.
We're almost there, Lada.
So, okay, turn it on and let's go.
I'm hoping we are almost there. There's about 10 seconds here.
Oh, good.
Okay. That was pretty sad, wasn't it?
We don't know the whole story, so we only know that side of it.
This seems weird, though, that somebody could stop a wedding. Is government coming in? You're not smart enough to get married.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't think anybody's smart enough to get married.
Yeah. It's a hard thing. An awful lot of blind people get married and then don't stay married. But anyway, so we ready for that?
Not quite. It's a very difficult piece because what happened was is it overlapped and it overdubbed and I lost the spot. So and it's rather a long interview as well with John. So it was like and it crossed over with our other. Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, it's a 95-minute tape.
You didn't turn the tape.
No, it didn't matter. It's not turning the tape. The tape automatically turns,
mm-hmm.
and it overplayed on part of the other side. So it's where it's a long story.
Something was done incorrectly.
So we're almost there.
We should be ready. And anyway, so do you have something else that you wanted to read or talk about? I've gone through all of our backup.
I think this is going to be on in 10 seconds, but I'm not.
Well, go ahead.
Counting,
why don't you just
counting
put it right on?
Waiting.
So we've finished most of our articles, and I'm sure the folks at home have been listening to the healthcare brouhaha. And who knows what's going to happen there? I haven't had a chance to read any of the bill at all, and I really don't know anybody who's really read it. So it's really hard to comment on something that you haven't read for yourself to know what it's all about. But I think they're wasting a lot of time. I think it should just be a single payer. I think it should be based on the Medicare setup, which works very well. And why reinvent the wheel? I mean, they're making their work much harder than it needed to be.
I agree.
But I guess they just have to show us that they're working, because for the most part, they don't do much down there in Congress.
I thought this Baucus, I guess.
Oh, did you find it?
Sorry, what?
Is it all set now?
No, it's driving me insane.
Well,
so,
just say what you have.
I can't because it's not even part of the program. So I'm going to rewind again, and I'm trying to. I apologize for having this archaic system. They promised that they were supposed to have a new system in next week, but. I don't know if that's going to happen. And in the meantime, we have to play. I mean, I'm more.
We'll play the other interview that we had, if that's clearer.
What's up?
Play the other interview, the second interview that we had.
I can't play any of them. The tape is. It, 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 it's all intertwined. It's all screwed up. I wish I was.
Well, you
I
didn't
wish
do
I
it right.
Canceled this show.
Well, let's go into some other news. Right now. So let's do that right now because you're just wasting your time with that interview.
I can't.
Since you can't get
all of it. It's just. So we are going to be.
We have other news that we can bring to you, and we'll do that right now. So let's do that.
Okay. Hang on one second, folks.
We just have to bring it up, and then we'll be able to bring you some of this news.
Sometimes it's just not worth doing. Okay.
Here's one. A member of Congress proposes to use taxpayer money to fund the development of technology to track motorists as part of a new form of taxation. U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer, Democrat of Oregon, introduced House H.R. 3311 earlier this year to appropriate $154,500,000 for research and study into the transition to a per-mile vehicle tax system. The road user free pilot project would be administered by the U.S. Treasury Department. The agency, in turn, would issue millions in taxpayer-backed grants to well-connected commercial manufacturers of tolling equipment to help develop the required technology. Within 18 months of the measure's passage, the department would file an initial report outlining the best methods for adopting the new federal transportation tax. This sounds a little scary.
Yeah, and we're just going to get the rest of that in just a second here. Nope. Mercury must be in retrograde. It's got to be.
Oregon has successfully tested a vehicle miles traveled fee, and it's time to expand and test the vehicle VMT program across the country, Blumenauer said in a statement on the bill's introduction. A VMT system can better assess fees based on use of our roads and bridges, as well as during times of peak congestion, than a fee based on fuel consumption. It's time to get creative and find smart ways to rebuild and renew America's deteriorating infrastructure.
In 2006, the Oregon Department of Transportation completed its own study of how to collect revenue from motorists with a new form of tax that, like the existing fuel excise tax, imposes a greater charge on drivers the more they drive. The pilot project's final report summed up the need for an VMT tax. Unfortunately, there is a growing perception among members of the public and legislators that fuel taxes have little to do with road programs and therefore should be considered just another form of taxation. And the March 2006 report stated, by itself, this situation appears to be preventing any increases in fuel tax rates from being put into effect. And that's the problem with this. I mean, you thought that it was supposed to be that all your gasoline taxes were supposed to be going to
roads. Oh, they go to the general fund.
Infrastructure. You know, everything just gets plopped into the general fund, and your goddamn bankers wind up getting it. You know what I mean? And bailouts and politicians and their pork, crap, and whatever else they can put in their pockets. So it's like it's a nightmare, folks. And it's something that's got to be.
Why don't they properly use the tax money they have instead of taxing us more?
Yeah, I mean, proposed no tax money. I mean, thankfully, they put the bill in, but it didn't pass. Hopefully, they got it won't. Here's something else that's kind of interesting, and I don't know if I can believe it all, but it comes from let's see who's.
This is on George Soros.
Yeah, Republic enemy number one. Let's see what they're talking about here.
This is from the Canadian Free Press.
Yeah. And Soros, Republic enemy number one. The main obstacle to a stable and just world order is the United States, says George Soros. George Soros is an evil man. He's anti-God, anti-family, anti-American, and anti-good. Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson, whoever that was. And it is possible to lay the global financial meltdown, the radicalizing of the Democratic Party, and the American and America's moral decline at the feet of one man. It is indeed possible. If George Soros isn't the world's preeminent malignant messianic narcissist, he'll do until the real thing comes along. Move over Hitler, Stalin, Mao, and Pol Pot. There's a new kid on the block. What we have in Soros is a multi-billionaire atheist with skewed moral values and a sociopath's lack of conscience. He considers himself to be a world-class philosopher, despises capitalism, and just loves social engineering. Can you say trouble, boys and girls? Soros is a real-life version of Dr. Evil with Obama in the role of Mini-Me, which is not as humorous as it might at first sound. In fact, it's bone-deep chilling. This is a frightening article here.
Well, they haven't really said anything yet. They've besmirched the guy without any substance. So I'm waiting for the substance.
I've read stuff on Soros.
Well,
they haven't said anything.
Go ahead.
Georgie Schwartz, better known in the world as George Soros, was born August 12, 1930 in Hungary. Soros' father, Tivadar, was a fervent practitioner of Esperanto, a language invented in... I don't think this thing is going to go anywhere. It's a long article, and everybody knows the guy, but Canadian Free Press had a tendency to be a little...
Well, they haven't said anything of substance. They just
called
them a lot of names.
You get to half an article and you get nothing there. It's like the rest of it ain't worth crap either. FDA is okay. Four fine swine flu vaccines, virtually unproven and untested.
Well, we've done a lot on swine.
We've done a lot. Chemtrail connection, H1N1 connection.
This would be an interesting article.
Okay. Let me.
Right
go,
here, since really.
Yeah, let me go to the whole article. InfoWars.
Since we couldn't bring you the interview.
Yeah, we apologize for that. It's just technical crap. Chemtrail, H1N1 connection.
This is from Skywatch of Canada.
Right. Since early March of 2009, the skies over Canada's capital have been littered with chemtrails dispensed by jets and resembling Boeing passenger 747s. It all started about a week or so before swine flu news hit the mainstream. From that point on, the amount of chemtrails being sprayed into the skies has gradually intensified. So the question that needs to be asked is, what is being sprayed into our skies and why? It is known among certain groups of people that chemtrails consist mainly of barium salts and aluminum. This cocktail appears as a white spray, similar to a contrail, but lingers in the sky, and once dispersed can easily be mistaken for high altitude clouds. Some have even witnessed planes spraying a brown substance from low altitudes. This substance, which has been observed, lands on the ground as a stringy, sticky gel. This gel has previously been analyzed by the Washington State Department of Health and AM Test Laboratory. It appeared to be composed of red blood cells mixed with biological agents. What are the implications of such incidences, and what have they become more? What have they become more frequent in recent months?
Meanings, why have they become more frequent?
In addition to increased chemtrail activities, the skies in the nation's capital have seen a drastic change in flight patterns of what appear to be commercial 747s or lookalikes. Planes have been flying lower than they ever have in the last 20 years. They've been flying lower here, too. You know this,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And these jets make rounds over residential neighborhoods flying at altitudes as low as 500 feet. That's exactly what's going on here. And the neighborhoods that are a good 40 kilometers away from the Ottawa airport. They seem to leave the airport, fly in a circle over the city at extremely low altitudes, and go back where they came from. The frequency of this type of occurrence is drastically increasing. The people need to ask why. How come there are planes flying low over houses every 5 minutes? There certainly aren't that many commercial flights coming in and out of Ottawa. Are the citizens being acclimated for some future event? On the topic of barium, it is known that it is toxic to humans. Not only does it disrupt digestive tract functions, but it affects the immune system. The immune system destroys pathogens by producing T cells. Barium is known to bind to T cell receptors and effectively deactivate them. It is just a coincidence that we are being warned about a deadly reemergence of H1N1 this fall, and our immune systems are being assaulted on a daily basis with barium? Probably not. In regard to low-flying jets, is it possible that they are practicing to release a bioweapon over densely populated areas? It has been said that biological agents must be released at lower altitudes to ensure they aren't damaged by low temperatures found at high altitudes. Everybody knows that NWO, New World Order crowd, likes to acclimate the sheep. This sets the stage for a coordinated release of some bioweapon, as Steve Quayle has previously spoken of. There are actually reports coming in that such an event may be in the works. Most pieces of evidence are mere eyewitness accounts, but such is the world of intelligence. This kind of information would never make it into the mainstream news. In March 2009, a YouTube video was released of a call someone made to a radio show called The Power Hour. The caller had been in touch with a truck driver working on contract for the Department of Homeland Security. He was getting paid $500 a load for trucking bird flu vials to various destinations within the U.S. All of the deliveries were made at night, and the trucks were all escorted by armed undercover ex-cops private security. Many of the loads were either picked up or dropped off at underground missile silos. The personnel receiving deliveries were often in full hazmat gear. The truck driver and his family were inoculated for protection against bird flu. This truck driver was paid at a Bank of America branch in a back room. He anonymously gave a number to the bank and was paid in cash on the spot. He was summoned randomly by Department of Homeland Security for meetings at 3 a.m. and examined regularly to make sure he had not contacted the virus.
One of his colleagues, who owned an especially long flatboat, was hired as part of the operation to haul an 80-ton missile across the country. The extremely heavy load blew its brakes, and the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, promptly reacted and had them immediately fixed so he could complete the delivery. Many of the truck driver's deliveries were extremely mysterious in nature. He was often told to drive an empty truck from one location to another, then one was stopped at random site and led down a private road to a drop-off point, many of which were underground missile silos, so if interrogated, he could not divulge sensitive information. At one of
his deliveries, he delivered clear refrigerated vials containing white liquid, which was then loaded into a military C-130 plane. The driver earned at least
$100,000.
$100,000 delivering these loads. He and his family have since been relocated to safe housing on a military base. The woman who called in this information to the radio show has presented it to the local police and the FBI. The response from both of them was, "This thing is so big we won't touch it with a 10-foot pole." Obviously, something big is afoot. In addition to truck drivers, solely one of Steve Quayle's credible intelligence sources divulges the following information on August 25, 2009. One notable report from the Flaming George Recreation...
Gorge.
A Flaming Gorge Recreation Area in Utah, Wyoming, and near Colorado cited large numbers of Italian men in one cabin and large numbers of Frenchmen in another, all speaking only in Italian and French. Also, this report included excellent detail of some of these getting on Harley-Davidson motorcycles after a Chinook helicopter passed over the lodge. They were seen riding out to meet the Chinook and receiving something from it, which then was taken back to the lodge. Noticeable were the large numbers of coolers at these receptive cabins, perhaps the type that might keep samples of some virus or flu cool enough for preservation until samples were to be distributed. With all the clues available, it is possible to conceive that after unsuspecting citizens have consumed excess amounts of barium, which has made its way from the clouds into the sewer system and back into drinking water, that we are caught in a globalist conspiracy to lower our immune systems for the coming second wave of the so-called swine flu. Will there be a synchronized aerosol release of weaponized influenza on the masses, or will there be live virus in addition to deadly amounts of squalene inside the H1N1 vaccine, or both? In terms of a method to achieve population reduction, bioweapons can theoretically be the most effective, only second to nuclear fallout, perhaps because after the initial release, it continues to spread and multiply among humans. It's evident from all of the mainstream propaganda about swine flu these days that we are being prepared for something big, even if the current swine flu outbreak up to this point has been no more than a joke. Time is running out for Obama and the New World Order crowd to seize dictatorial control of North America. The masses are awakening at an unprecedented rate. And how will the next few months unfold? Who will be victorious? God save the Republic. Interesting. I think it's happening, too. I think people are starting to wake up, especially with the vaccines and with everything else, you know? And I've suspected this these chemtrails for a long, long time. You know, that, you know, so, and we've talked about this incredible amount of many times on the show. People don't seem to, you know, to want to get it. Let's see. I don't know where this is. This is in...
No, that's no good.
Okay. Rothschild's Zionists and Sarkozy ramps up Iran nuclear weapon hype in defense of Israel. As major world powers voice readiness to hold talks with Iran about concerns over the country's nuclear work, France moves to raise new allegations against the Islamic Republic. It is a certainty to all of our secret services. Iran is working today on a nuclear weapons program, French Prime President Sarkozy told lawmakers from his conservative UMP party on Tuesday. We cannot let Iran acquire nuclear weapons because it would also be a threat to Israel, he added. So what? Do I say?
The French toad.
He's a toady. He's a toady. And, yeah, and he looks like a toady. Let's see. Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Council, Russia,
Security
China,
Council.
Yeah, Russia, China, Britain, France, and U.S., plus Germany, have agreed to hold wide-ranging talks addressing global issues along with Tehran's nuclear program on October 1st, most probably in Turkey. The meeting arrangements come after Iran presented its new package of proposals to six major powers. And ahead of diplomatic negotiations between Iran and the West, the White House said on Tuesday that the U.S. President Barack Obama and Sarkozy held talks on ways to bring Iran into compliance. The two leaders discussed the status of diplomatic efforts to bring Iran into compliance with its international obligation on nuclear programs. I think that it goes on. And it's kind of a, it's kind of a moot point because I think that these guys all belong with. I think they should have nuclear weapons if Israel has nuclear weapons, and everybody around them has nuclear weapons.
Well, personally, I don't think anybody should have them, and
no,
I don't think we
them,
should either.
Well, if you got them,
I think they should all be dismantled.
That's a really good idea, but who's going to do it first?
Nobody.
Nobody.
Sick.
Ah. Snake born with hand shocks scientists. Look at that.
Yeah.
Look at that little hand. An elderly Chinese woman who discovered a snake with a clawed hand protruding from its body was so scared she beat it to death, according to reports. And,
Let's see what the rest
of it. Yeah, very bizarre. It's coming up, folks. It's a while. Maybe it's a Chinese newspaper.
Maybe, huh? Not in Chinese, though. We'd have to have it in English. I don't think it's coming up.
Yeah, it's transferring. We'll get there. Oh, I'd really like
some
to see
weird
that.
Things in the world.
I'd really like to see this. Yeah. 9 MSN. 9 News. Okay. Beat it to that. Yeah. So, an elderly woman who discovered a snake with a clawed hand protruding from its body was so scared that she beat it to death. Zi Kuang Dong. 68, told the Sinai Beijing news agency she woke up in the middle of the night to find a snake clinging to the wall of her bedroom.
Dude.
I woke up and I heard a strange scratching sound. At first, I thought it was thieves. I turned on the light and saw this monster working its way along the wall using his claw. Mrs. Duong from Sining in southwest China said she then grabbed a shoe and beat the snake to death. She reportedly preserved its body in a bottle of alcohol, which she gave to the life science department in China's West Normal University. Snake expert Long Shuai said the discovery of the creature, which is 40 centimeters long and the thickness of a little finger, was truly shocking. We won't know the cause until we've conducted an autopsy, she said. But it's very true. You can see a picture of it here. And very, very strange. Very strange. Sign of the end times, I guess. Oh, Rockefeller president and CEO commits suicide. James S. McDonald, president and chief executive of investment management firm Rockefeller and Company, has died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. Massachusetts authorities said Tuesday McDonald, 56, was found in his vehicle at about 3 p.m. Sunday behind a car dealership in Dartmouth, about 50 miles south of Boston. And a spokesman for the Bristol District Attorney's Office.
Huh.
Yeah. It must have been some serious investment fraud here.
Hmm. That's odd.
Hmm. And let's see. There was no note, but McDonald made a phone call to his wife earlier in the day. Without getting into specifics of the call, the death is still under investigation. Barclay Faden III, a longtime friend, said McDonald took his own life, and added that neither he nor the family had further comment. McDonald had been president and chief executive of the New York Investment Managers since 2001. The company was started in 1882 by John D. Rockefeller to manage the family's assets. Rockefeller and Company, which also has offices in Boston, Washington, and Wilmington, offers wealth and investment management services to families, foundations, and endowments. The company had $25 billion in assets under administration at the end of the last year. Jim McDonald was an exceptional individual, and so what? Austin Shepard, the company's chief operating and financial, had assumed day-to-day leadership of Rockefeller. McDonald, the resident, was also the board of directors. I guess there's no sign of any why he did it. I thought just interesting that the president would shoot himself. Chances are he...
Something must have happened.
Something big happened there. That's about it. And it's about the end of the show. We really apologize for not having the...
That's really too bad because it was
interview.
Quite a
it's good
very
one. Good. And if I can salvage it, maybe I can play it next week, another
time.
It's
too bad.
But there was a very serious problem with that... We will try again, and if we can save it, we'll put it together next week because it was a very good interview.
And in the meantime, we hope you have a good night.
We hope you do. And
take care.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening.
And good night.